Okay, hi everyone. Welcome to Feminist Buzz, where all the buzz around radical feminism happens. I'm here today with Courtney Mitchell, a pro-feminist male ally, and we're going to be talking about an article that he recently wrote and got published in DGR News Service. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No problem. Pleasure to have you. Courtney, can you just introduce yourself briefly for our audience?
Sure. So I'm Courtney Mitchell, and I am currently a member of the Green Resistance, currently living in the northern part of Georgia in the United States. I've been doing pro-feminist work, aspiring male ally work for about eight years or so. And I've done some other kinds of activism and just getting into radical environmentalism, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So the article we're discussing today is called Let's Get Free, Escalate the Fight to End Male Violence. And we're going to have a link to it in the description so people can check that out. I recommend that everyone read it. So just in like 30 seconds, can you sort of summarize what the article is about and what your main argument is?
Sure. So Let's Get Free is my column on the DGR News Service. And basically, this article came out of just thinking a lot about what it will take to actually kind of change the tide of male violence in this culture. And I've done a lot of education and training young people, mostly college-age students, but also some younger people as well, giving workshops and lectures and speeches and doing all kinds of educational type work to help get people excited and motivated about anti-violence.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout a lot of that work, one of the kind of unspoken issues that go along with that kind of work is that a lot of times we still don't see a drop in the numbers of men committing violence against women and children.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we see an increase in that violence. And I was, in the radical movement, we have an analysis that says, ultimately we have to get to the root of the problem, and
mm-hmm.
we have to kind of talk about what it will take to end the problem. We can't just focus on reforming these negative institutions, these oppressive institutions. We have to talk about what it will take to end these institutions once and for all. And so it came out of thinking, what can men do? What is men's role in ending violence against women? And that's kind of the direction I took with the article.
So. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read part of it here. You write, quote, "I have the shame of being a man, that sex caste category that has socialized me to be abusive and to be callous towards other men's abuse of women and children. I have the shame of knowing that I benefit from large-scale violence against women, the subordination and objectification and public humiliation of half the world's population in the name of masculinity and manhood. But that shame is not enough. I can see that my shame has not changed men's behavior. Shame has not prevented our fists from breaking women's jaws, our penises from torturing women's bodies, our words from dismissing their experiences," unquote. So I found that really interesting, because one of the things that I've noticed as well in doing this work is that sometimes when men are confronted with the reality of what's going on and what women face, their first sort of reaction is to feel guilty. And I think that's understandable. And I think it's, a sort of a psychologically sane reaction to what's going on. But I think there's a potential danger with some men where they get stuck in that guilt. And it's just, they sort of focus a lot on their own feelings, and it's all about, they feel bad and they don't know what to do, and they kind of get stuck at that,
Absolutely. I agree 100%. I think guilt can be very paralyzing. I think what guilt does is it can get us in touch initially with that part of ourselves that know that we are culpable in a harm that's being done, or that we have actually committed that harm. And guilt can act as a deterrent. We know what it feels like, and so we can make a decision not to go that route again, which is always good. But what a lot of men do when we're confronted with the reality of benefiting from men's violence against women, the fact that we live every day of our life privileged to not be, most of the time we're not the victims, you know, the danger accrues to women in this culture. And a lot of times men, when we start hearing these, you know, being held accountable for a lot of these issues that, you know, that are rooted in masculinity and manhood, what we do is we kind of shut down and we say, oh, you know, not all men are like that. You know, I'm a good guy. I've never done anything like this before. You know, I don't objectify women and all these things, but what men are really afraid of is being held accountable and really realizing that culpability every day of our lives, even if we're not actually committing violence against women, when we don't speak out against other men doing the same thing, when we don't hold the men around us accountable for their sexist behavior, we are culpable in that behavior. We are implicated in the culture at large that facilitates this kind of abuse towards women, that facilitates men's violence and rage and anger that leads to this violence. And so we can be guilty for a while. I mean, we can have that shame and we can have that regret, but we need to act. I mean, women don't need men's guilt. It's just as much as people of color don't need white people's guilt, and indigenous people don't need settlers' guilt. What they need is the action to destroy the institutions that are oppressing them. And I think that is, you know, that's one of the primary roles that men can take, as well as undoing the culture from the inside.
Yeah, I think it's important that you mention that, because I know there are some men who are going to be watching this or listening to this, and they're going to be thinking, well, okay, you know, violence against women is wrong, but I'm not participating in it. You know, I haven't raped anyone. I don't beat my wife. And they might be thinking to themselves, like in their immediate circle, they might not know anyone who's being abused, or they don't think they know anyone who's being abused. And so they think, well, I guess that makes me off the hook, right? What would you say to men like that? What do you think men can do, you know, in their communities, for example?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it's probably one of the first reactions that men have. I know for sure it was my initial reaction when I first began studying pro-feminism when I was in college. And, you know, I always considered myself a good guy. And, oh, I don't do these things. You know, I'm not like those guys, blah, blah, blah. But I think what men have to understand is that when we speak about large-scale men's violence against women and we speak about the culture, we're not speaking about individuals per se. I mean, it is individual men who are committing the violence and making decisions that affect women's lives in this way. But for the most part, we know that the vast majority of the violence is being done by a specific group of violent men, violent abusive men, violent and controlling men who have been socialized into using rage and just being completely inconsiderate of life, just to put it bluntly.
Right.
We are speaking about a cultural phenomenon, and even if men aren't being violent, we behave in sexist ways in pretty much every other part of our daily life. Whenever we make a rape joke, no matter how harmless we think it is, we say that linebacker got raped, if we say that Tess raped us, if we watch misogynistic music videos and buy products that are marketed on the objectification of women's bodies, if we consume porn, any of those, I mean, there is 100 different actions on a daily basis that men routinely participate in that implicate us in this large scale violence against women and the subordination of women as a class. And so, I mean, there is hardly any man on the planet who can say that they are not culpable in some way. You know, we can use pretty strong language, like when we say that men hate women, when we say that, it's a statement on the behavior of men as a whole. I mean, if we look at the behavior of men on a societal scale, what else can we say? I mean, what else can we call it? I don't even have any other language to describe it other than men hate women. That's the only way that a third of all women of the world can be raped. it's the only way that can happen is if men hate them and use it as a tool of punishing women, essentially. And so some of the things we can start to do right now is to swear off forever masculine, controlling, dominative behavior. We have to radicalize. Men have to begin to think about and strongly consider adopting the radical analysis, and that is a critique of masculinity and a critique of manhood. And I think that's the very first thing is to say, I am going to focus on being a human being first and not being a man, not being this masculine, you know, macho type of person that society wants me to be, that my family wants me to be, or that my friends want me to be. I have to, you know, one of the things I like to say is, what conceptions of masculinity and manhood are not present in conceptions of basic goodness and basic humanity? Let's pull apart what being a person is, what being a human being is, and let's pull apart what being a man is. What are the differences between these two? That's where we can meet. And we can start to have a discussion about the differences between being a human being and being a man. And when we really start to have that conversation, manhood and masculinity is exposed for exactly what it is. And this is what feminists have been saying for so long, that it's based in domination and based in control. So men have to swear off that socialization and that conditioning. We have to begin to root that out of ourselves. And then we can start talking about taking actions against other men who are committing this violence against women, or institutions that are perpetuating this culture.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few things that I'm thinking as you're saying that. One is, not too long ago, I was doing some research just for myself, basically, about various psychological disorders. And one of the things that I was looking at was sociopaths. And I think the clinical term is antisocial something disorder, personality disorder. But anyway, it's basically, I was looking at what, like, the actual psychological criteria for what makes a sociopath. And one of the things that struck me was that, so many of the criteria were basically, you know, almost like exaggerated masculine traits. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like being a sociopath is kind of like being masculine, like taken to its logical conclusion. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I found, you know, that's not to say, just to be clear, that's not to say that all men are sociopaths. That's not what I'm saying. And that's not what Courtney was saying, but it's, you know, it's just to show that these quote unquote normal behaviors that men and boys are taught are, you know, on a continuum with, you know, extremely unhealthy behaviors.
And it's so manifest.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's so clearly manifest in this society. We don't even have to look very far. We can turn on the nightly news every single night and see examples of men manifesting psychopathic, sociopathic behavior. The funny thing is, we're very quick to point out, well, maybe not most people. I think we're faster to point out the interpersonal level of this kind of behavior. But then when we talk about entire institutions that are basically run by men, I mean, we're talking about governments and militaries and corporations and, you know, other institutions that also perpetuate this kind of behavior. And even on that level, it's really hard to get people to see it, and get people to name it for what it is. And that's kind of the direction I really wanted to take with the article, is say, hey, look, there are institutions, there are real people with names, with addresses, with, you know, locations in space and time that are committing this violence against women. And men have got to step up and name the problem and name the men who are doing it, name the institutions that are responsible, and then work to dismantle those institutions.
Mm-hmm. So for other men who are watching this, I'm going to have a link in the description to a book called Getting Off Pornography and the End of Masculinity by Robert Jensen. And it talks about a lot of the things that Courtney is talking about here, like, you know, being a man versus being a human, about the connection between masculinity as a gender role and then, you know, competitive or unhealthy social structures in other parts of life, for example, the marketplace, you know, the economy. So I'm going to have a link to that. But I just want to go back to Courtney's article here. And I want to read this paragraph. You write, quote, "We have to do more than just recite the numbers or watch the films or attend the conferences. We must do more than just abstain from consuming sexist, violent media or purchasing consumer goods sold on the marketing of women's bodies. We must do more, a whole lot more. Some of us are going to have to stop abusive men. Some of us are going to have to put our bodies on the line, place our bodies in between these men and the women they intend to abuse. And while physical intervention in interpersonal violence is not the primary focal point of men's work against patriarchy, and it is not applicable in most cases, pro-feminist men should support such actions when done in a smart, strategic manner." And then you also write a bit before that, quote, "Many of us have traveled the world speaking, marching, picketing, and participating in myriad forms of nonviolent protest in support of the feminist and anti-violence movement. And yet, the rate of men's violence against women is increasing. Our work has been ineffective in bringing about lasting change. The change that we do manage to see is the result of generations of brave and courageous women who bled and died and were imprisoned for fighting for their right to be treated as human beings." So I think in many ways this kind of gets to the heart of what you're saying in this article, because there's this really, I guess, popular idea that that social change comes through education, you know, either primarily through education or even entirely through education. And I was actually just having this conversation with, you know, what you could call some liberal feminists a few days ago, kind of more mainstream, not radical feminists. Mm-hmm. And they were basically saying, you know, we just need to educate men and educate them and educate them, and eventually they'll be forced to see that patriarchy isn't fair and that they should treat us as equals and all these things. But I guess what you're saying in the article, and this is something I strongly believe as well, is that, you know, that might work for a small number of men, but it's really not going to work for most men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think we can really see the truth of that reality by just looking at the culture, just taking a step back and looking at the culture. What messages are present in this culture that would convince the vast majority of men to change their behavior and become more decent, more caring, you know, more just human beings? Where are men supposed to get this message?
Mm-hmm.
We're saying that we just need to educate men. How many of us are out there actually educating men? And how many men are we going to reach? Like, how many, and how much time do we have? Mm-hmm. Every 2 minutes, a woman is either beaten or raped. So let's really take into account here how long it's going to take to reach, you know, some kind of groundswell of male body people and say, okay, now we have enough men to educate that we can end this problem. I hate to say it. I really do hate to say this. And this is something that, you know, that people who adopt the radical analysis struggle with all the time. But social change does not happen by asking. It does not happen by education. Social change happens by force. And if we can look at the history of, you know, social change movements all around the world, every single large-scale social change movement has had a nonviolent side, and it also had a more militant, more radical side to it. And the two complement each other. And so when we're, you know, if I want to start, sit down and think about writing an article about what can men do to end men's violence once and for all, well, some of us are going to have to adopt the radical analysis, and some of us are going to have to actually fight against these institutions. We don't take it lightly. I mean, we're not, you know, this is not child's play. This is very serious, very, very serious work that is only, you know, that is taken on by people who are capable and able and have the temerity to really kind of take it on. The rest of us are doing support work. You know, the rest of us are doing the educating and are doing, but we're also loudly and vocally supporting resistance and supporting mm-hmm. women who defend themselves against men. We, you know, the idea is to, you know, voice our support of women who take their safety and their autonomy and their freedom into their own hands and choose not to submit to men's violence anymore. We vocally support that. And that's where I think a lot of sort of the liberal analysis and sort of the educational side of it kind of misses the mark. I mean, we are seriously, seriously out of time. We do not have the time to educate enough people to where we can start to see changes from a from that perspective. We need to dismantle these institutions now, like right now, because these institutions are not only oppressing human, you know, human people, women, children. They're also, you know, these institutions are destroying the planet. These institutions are essentially committing genocide against hundreds of different indigenous cultures around the world. These institutions are ripping apart the very fabric of life on this planet. And this is, you know, this is not, people consider it an exaggeration. If we just look at the evidence, we can see this happening. But even if the other parts of it weren't the case, even if the environmental destruction and, you know, destruction of indigenous cultures, if we're just talking about it from a feminist perspective, like I said, every 2 minutes. And so it's like, there has to be a sense of urgency eventually. You have to get to the point where we say enough is enough. Like, men have been ineffective up until this point. Men have been on the sidelines, allowing women, you know, the essentially being the only ones who are protecting and defending each other. And men have just kind of stood back and said, we're just going to educate. We can't afford to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, eventually we're going to have to dismantle these institutions and we're going to have to stop abuse of men, or else they're just not going to stop. We want to think that people can change. You know, we want to think that people can, you know, have a change of heart, and some people can, but these are adult men who make these decisions. And, you know, I remember when I first started studying domestic violence when I was in college, you know, I first learned that abusers will intentionally strike their partner, strike women, strike children in places that other people can't see. So they're not necessarily, you know, hitting someone in the face. Right, hitting a woman in the face. They'll hit them in the arm because they know that they're going to wear a shirt with a sleeve and no one else is going to see that bruise there. You know, these men, these abusive men know what they're doing. I mean, we can talk about fits of blind rage if we want, but a lot of these cases, these men know what they're doing. They're intentionally abusing for specific reasons to, you know, to silence, to intimidate, to humiliate, to break the woman's spirit, to break that child's spirit down. And, you know, to essentially to eliminate them as a threat to their violence and their abuse and their control. So we have to start taking men seriously. When these men, you know, are out saying that they're going to massacre women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, men are just saying this out loud in public. And where is the outcry from men? Where are men saying, no, we're not going to let this happen in our society anymore. Like, men, they're just not saying this. And so we have to start taking these abusive men seriously. They say they're at war. We need to believe them. And we say, okay, you're going to go to war with the women, you know, with women in our families, our friends, women we love, women we don't know, women around the world. You're going to go to war with women, them. You're going to go to war with us. And I think that's, I don't know what else to say to men. I mean, that's,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, as you're saying this, there's a couple of things that come to my mind. One is that patriarchy is actually very old. Like, it's been around for literally thousands of years. And so when I hear people, usually liberal feminists, saying, well, you know, men are going to be involved in feminism on a mass scale because, you know, masculinity hurts their feelings, you know, I always wonder, why has that not happened for the past, you know, 6,000 plus years? Like, what is it about right now that's so magically different that there's just going to be this mass movement of men that's never existed before? You know, it honestly strikes me as delusional. And I think a lot of us actually can understand that it's delusional in other contexts. Like, for example, if we're talking about economic injustice, and if somebody said to you, you know, the 1% live really shallow lives and they're not happy people, and so maybe there's going to be this mass movement of them giving up their wealth and giving up their power. I mean, we would laugh at that. You know, it's easy to see how delusional that is, because I mean, yeah, you know, even if you know, I read a story about one guy who inherited a ton of money and then he decided to give it away and go back to being working class because he found the lifestyle really shallow and, you know, whatever. And good for him, but, you know, that's never going to happen on a mass scale. We know that that's an isolated, rare case. And we, you know, whatever people's opinion is about economic injustice, regardless of whether, you know, whatever stance people have on it, I don't think anybody, you know, has ever seriously said or taken seriously this idea that the 1% are just going to give up their wealth. You know, it's just, it's delusional. But it, when it comes to patriarchy and when it comes to male supremacy, for some reason we want to believe that if only enough men are educated, there's going to be this magical mass movement.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you saying that. I really do, because, you know, it's funny when I think of it from the perspective of the anti-racist movement and, you know, the Black liberation movement, a part of the history of that is recognizing that, you know, white-skinned people as a whole are not going to give up the privilege. A lot of them won't even admit that they have privilege. This is something that I don't understand why it's so hard for people to see. Men have a hard time admitting they even have privilege.
Mm-hmm.
We have to spend several workshops in a row just to get men to start to see their privilege. I mean, I remember training college students over and over again. Like, I would go in for a class, you know, like they'd invite the peer education group in for a discussion. We'd have an hour to convince everyone in there that there's a such thing as male privilege and that women are oppressed and under patriarchy. And we would leave and we maybe reach two people, you know, and it's like, we do this over and over and over again. We can show them all the stats. We can say that men commit 94% of all child sexual abuse in the world. I mean, what else can we say to people to get them to see it? If they still don't see it, there's something that's not working. And the reason, I think, is everything in the culture convinces men that they are human beings and that women are not. Everything in the culture tells men that masculine behavior, you know, domination behavior, using coercion, using force, using violence, is what it means to be a man, and it's a good thing, and it's rewarded in this culture. We are privileged because of that behavior. There is no amount of education that can get so many men in so many different places around the world to all of a sudden start seeing this clearly when all of the other messages are counter to that. We can't compete with the culture. What we have to do is start talking about what it will take to end the violence. And to end the violence, we have to end the culture. We have to start undoing the culture from the inside out. However we can, whatever our capacity to be able to do that, we have to start to do that. And we just can't wait. I mean, that's just like the environmental movement saying, you know, we have to continue to try to reach a mass movement. We have to try to get as many people as possible involved. Okay, but every single day we fail to do that, the earth is in worse shape. Like, every single day another forest falls. Every single day, you know, the tar sands are, you know, contaminating water and killing species by the dozens, by the hundreds every single day. I mean, at some point we have to say, this is not working. You know, I mean, the next time I hear, God, I've lost count of how many women in my life have been abused by men. I've lost count of how many conversations I've had with friends who have been abused or who known someone they've been abused or a friend who just lost a friend to male violence. You know, I mean, it's just, God, like at one point we start to say, you know, we can't be patient about this anymore. The situation is dire. I mean, it's extremely dire. The levels of violence in this culture are absurd. It's obscene on a point to sane people, it would feel like living in a different world. And I think this is the urgency that people have to get. We can educate till the cows come home. I love education. That's essentially what I do.
Right.
On a regular basis. But education's not going to get it done. Some of us are going to have to fight. And I hate to say that. I don't want to. I don't want that to be the case. Because I don't like fighting.
But, right.
you know, these men are not going to stop abusing. They're just not. They've proven it to us. They've told us they won't. And we have to, like I said, we have to start taking them seriously.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's important to understand, too, is that, you know, there are some people, whether male or female, who are going to listen to this and they're going to say, well, you know, violence isn't for me. You know, even if that's the case, I think it's important to understand that that force is the only language that power understands either way. And what I mean by that is that even if you're not willing to use violence, you know, even if you prefer completely nonviolent methods, the point is, you know, we're not going to get to where we want to get to just by asking men nicely. So, you know, if you're not willing to go through the personal, I get the more personal kind of direct action route, then think about maybe, you know, there's different things, but think about maybe legal mechanisms that are going to take away male power. Think about meaningful ways to disrupt the porn industry. Think about, you know, and anything that's going to get in the way of male power, because I think it's important to understand that, you know, oppression isn't just about ideas, and men don't commit violence against women just because they have bad ideas about women. I mean, they do hate women and they do have unhealthy ideas, but it's also about concrete, specific material rewards that men often get. So, for example, men generally tend to earn more money. Men generally own more land across the world. Men are taken more seriously when they speak up, whether it's on political issues or in the workplace. Men are more likely to be promoted at work. Men have, I would say basically everywhere in the world, men have control over women's sexuality. And in many parts of the world, they control women's reproductive processes as well. So, you know, so it's not just that they have these bad ideas in their head. That's part of it. But it's also that there's these material things that they get out of it. And so even if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, I hate violence, I'm a pacifist, or, you know, I just can't personally do violence, or violence is too militant, or whatever it is that you're thinking, the point is we need to take power away from men. And there's violent and nonviolent ways to do that. But I think it's important to understand that education alone is not going to get us very far.
And it could if we had enough people. Like if we had, you know, it's like saying, oh, let's educate about the pipelines that are tearing through indigenous communities right now. Well, you know, if we had 100,000 people that we could switch out, you know, whenever a bunch of us get arrested, we could shut down a pipeline very easily. But we don't have enough people to be able to use nonviolence and enough people to be able to educate ourselves out of this quagmire that we're in, ecologically, socially, globally. You know, it's the situation, we're just too far in. We're too far in to rely on nonviolent methods at this point in time. One of the things I want to say about men's abuse and add to what you just said so very well, I think this idea of extraction of resources, and I first started learning about this when Rachel Ivey first started talking about it, and you know, she's been on tour and she talks about the extraction of resources and how all oppression is tied to resource extraction. So we can look at it from the terms of, okay, in the environmental movement we say these companies are extracting oil, they're extracting natural gas, they're, you know, they're extracting rare earth minerals and rocks and those kinds of things, and this action is destroying the planet. Well, we can say that men extract sexual benefits from women when they rape women. Men extract sexual gratification, they extract resources from women, they essentially steal women's pay on a daily basis. Men essentially steal women's wealth by, I can't even think of all the different ways that men do this.
Right.
I mean, men earn more. They own, like you said, they own more land. I mean, this is theft. This is all theft. This is a patriarchal system and a culture that facilitates the oppression of women and privileges men who do that. And so it's like trying to take a piece of candy from a baby and expecting them not to put up a fight. I mean,
right.
Men are, we're pacified in this culture to be addicted to that power and addicted to that privilege. And men will do whatever it takes to keep that privilege. This is why men rape. This is why men use violence. This is why violent people use violence, because violence works. And that is a really hard truth to get across to people. But violence works. That's why they use it. This is why oppression and abuse is so effective, because violence essentially it pacifies people. It gets them to the point where they don't want to fight back. They don't think they can fight back. And so, of course, men are going to use it. Of course, you know, I remember Lear saying in the anti-domestic violence movement, it's widely known that one or two beatings a year will keep a woman in line, because it's that fear. It's that fear of the pain and the abuse and the suffering, and then not being able to get out of the situation one way or another. You know, it's just like, that's the reason why white racists use lynching. Lynching was a tool. It wasn't just white people going on a blind rage and lynching black people. It was a tool of oppression. It was terrorism. Just like rape is terrorism. Just like war is terrorism. I mean, these are the ways that violent and abusive people can keep an entire population in check and keep them subordinated to that culture, to that system. And so this is what we're up against. We're up against a culture that facilitates violence. We're up against a culture that encourages violence. And it's like saying we can talk or speak our ways out of abuse. We know that this is just not the case. Some of us are going to have to fight back eventually. And some of us are going to have to, you know, like you said, a lot of people will think, oh, I'm a pacifist, you know, I'm nonviolent, I can't. Okay, that's fine. Like, one of the things that I want to make sure I get across, I hope I got this across in the article, is that the vast majority of us are not frontline resistors. I mean, most of us are doing support work. Most of us are more or less behind the scenes supporting resistance. We speak in favor of resistance. We talk about what it will take to end the culture of violence. In the culture of ecological destruction on the planet, you know, we're basically just being vocal and loud about it. But some of us are going to have to do what it takes to bring down the culture. And then the rest of us support them in doing it. And if we honestly, like in ourselves, if we really can't support militant action, if we really can't, you know, talk about a diversity of tactics in this larger struggle, then at the very least, We should resolve to say we're not going to denounce those people who do. And this is another aspect of men's role in ending patriarchy once and for all, is to speak up often and loud and vocally about a woman's right to defend herself, about a child's right to defend themselves against abusive men, and to say, you know, we're never going to question, what was she thinking? Doesn't she know she's just going to get it worse next time? Or, you know, all this different stuff. Like, we have to start saying no. Like, there is no safe space for abusers anywhere at all. You know, you have a right to do whatever it takes to end the abuse, whatever it takes. And we will support you in doing that, you know. And that's one of the things we used to teach students when we would train them on bystander intervention and violence prevention. We would say, okay, you know what? If you approach that man who you just saw hit his partner in public, if you approach him and say, not cool, not going to stand here and let you do that, there is a chance that he could go home and do it again behind closed doors. Yeah, you know what? You can't control that. Like, right. That's not in our control. What we need to do right now is let the survivor know that we know what's going on. That this is no longer going to be a secret. We're going to talk about what's happening. We're going to do what we can to prevent what's happening. And if we can't prevent it, we're going to do what we can to make sure that justice is served. And this is one of the roles I think men can take in a larger region.
And I think, you know, for especially like some quote-unquote liberal or more mainstream feminists who are listening to this, I think there's sometimes surprise when you mention things like this, And I'm not sure why, because, look, the World Health Organization, which isn't, you know, they're not a radical feminist organization, but even they estimate that 1 in 3 women globally are going to be raped or beaten at some point in their lives. So for me as a radical feminist, and I think for other radical feminists and pro-RadFem allies, you know, when I use words like the war on women, to me that's not a metaphor. That's very literal. And I think for, you know, literally billions of women, that's also very literal. You know, it's something they experience very concretely, you know, in reality. And, you know, I think that some people don't see this as a war because it looks different from, you know, our traditional conception of war, where there's like one group of guys who represent some country and then another group of guys, and they fight sort of in this usually public place. Whereas with violence against women, it's often one man and he's doing it at home. And it's kind of this, superficially, if you don't examine it in depth, it looks like there's just these isolated men doing these things. But we need to understand that it is a systemic thing. And that these, you know, I consider batterers and rapists and pimps and child abusers and all these people to basically be the foot soldiers of the war on women. And I mean that literally. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, that we're too extreme, that we're too whatever, you know, I'm just going to ask you to consider that women's lives and children's lives matter enough that, you know, we can at least start talking about things like self-defense, for example. You know, I think that's, you know, long past due.
And I think it's so great that you mentioned, you know, Johns and pimps and rapists and the men who are committing the gross level type of violence, as being the foot soldiers for patriarchy. Because, you know, when I first saw Lear's presentation, Patriarchy versus Planet Earth, and she talks about how masculinity is, you know, masculinity is built upon a domination imperative. It's built on an imperative to violate boundaries. And this is what makes a good soldier. You have to train soldiers to kill. It doesn't come naturally. Lieutenant Corporal Dave Grossman, he was a former Army Ranger, paratrooper. He wrote a book called On Killing. It's become sort of a military classic.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how earlier last century, you know, before World War I, World War II era, when they were training infantrymen to shoot at targets, they noticed that even with the training, these men were not shooting. In battle, they were not firing their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of obvious reasons for this. One, because we have an aversion to killing.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings naturally avert killing. Now, human beings might do a lot of posing and posturing, and a lot of loudmouthing, but for the most part, we don't like violence. They had to teach these men to kill, and so what they started doing was they started using more lifelike targets in training. And then they started essentially desensitizing these men to war. And then they started objectifying who they called an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
They created a dichotomy of self and other. Dave Grossman talked about this in the book. Then I watched Lear's presentation, and she talks about the exact same thing, only she says that this is masculinity in general. This isn't just war and militarism. This is what masculinity does. It projects a self and an other, and then that other becomes an object, and the self becomes the most important aspect of life, and we can see this in men. Men objectify women every second of the day.
Right.
I mean, with every other thought, every message in society is objectifying women's bodies, objectifying women as less than human. And so this is not metaphorical when we say men are at war with women. The man who shot, I can't remember his name, but he was the man who had the most recent college campus shooting. You know, when reading his manifesto, he specifically said he wanted to kill women. I mean,
are you talking about Elliot Rodger?
Yes, Elliot
yeah.
Rodgers. That's
yeah.
I have a hard time remembering names, but.
yeah, that's okay.
He specifically said that. He said, I'm gonna go kill women. Like he, you know, he drew in his manifesto, he had pictures of women in graveyards.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the guy who just threatened Anita Sarkeesian, the social critic, and she's been talking a lot about sexism in video games. You know, a man wrote to the university she was going to speak at, saying, "If you allow her to speak, I'm going to massacre people on campus. I have all these weapons." I mean, at what point do we say, okay, these things are serious? Like, these guys are not kidding around, you know, and we know they're not kidding around because the mass shootings are happening. They're not just talking, they're doing it. And at some point we have to say, you know, something's got to change. I mean, we need a changing tide in this fight. We call it a war because that's what it is. It's a war. I mean, we would call it a war if, you know, our land base was being destroyed and our water was being polluted and the air was being polluted. You know, if all the life support systems are on us, I mean, this is a tactic of war. you destroy the infrastructure of the enemy and then you essentially attack and terrorize them so you can make them complacent and make them subordinate. You terrorize them. And this is what men do to women on a daily basis. We terrorize women. We terrorize children to the point where we break their will to fight. And at some point we have to start treating this like a campaign, like a fight. And I mean, I use that language very cautiously because I don't want men who, you know, they find themselves sympathetic to these issues. I don't want them to think that men's primary role is physical intervention. Like I said, you know, it's very clear that most of our work, 90% of our work is about undoing masculine culture and addressing sexism in other men and doing what we can to challenge the institutions and the individuals complicit in patriarchy. There are times when we can find ourselves in a position to intervene. You know, I found myself in a position one time, actually several times now that I think about it, in intervening in something that's happening in the moment. But I don't want men to glorify violence. Obviously, that's completely counterproductive. But we do have to be prepared to defend life, defend women, defend children when it is necessary and strategic to do so.
Right. So I don't think I have anything else I want to mention. Do you have anything else you want to wrap up with?
Well, I would definitely implore men to start asking questions and start allowing yourself to think about these issues and bring up these issues with the other men who are around us. That's one of that's the first step. It really is addressing our own sexism and then speaking with other men about it. And you know what? The funny thing is, the more you do it, the easier it becomes. There's a lot of risk involved when you start to speak up. You know, not every man is going to take you seriously. They might get defensive. They might get violent. Men will defend their privilege with violence if necessary. Men will defend it. And so we have to be prepared. But, you know, the conversation is the first start. And then from that point on, we need to start talking about serious resistance. And I would encourage pro-feminist men who have already started doing some work in some ways to radicalize. And to start to study the radical analysis as best you can, and to start to have these discussions with others who have that same analysis so we can really get to work on contributing to the end of patriarchy and the end of men's violence. So I would encourage men to start doing that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have a bunch of links as well in the description of this video, including Courtney's article. I'd highly recommend that everyone read it. And then I'm also going to have the Robert Jensen book that I mentioned and some other links to things from DGR, Deep Green Resistance, so you can learn more about them and more things about masculinity. So if you're watching this and wondering where to go next from here, the description of this video is going to have lots of things for you. And don't forget to subscribe. And Feminist Buzz now also has a Twitter handle. It's @FeministBuzz, so be sure to follow us there. And thanks so much for being here, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
No problem.